The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
Matt
Boone Media Productions.
You remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know
who, what, where, when, why.
We having fun, yeah. Why It Ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon.
What up, guys? Welcome to hashtag Why It Ended Wednesday this week. We're back. It's Why It Ended. Last week, we had a great episode with the Prince of Punk, Shannon Moore. This week, we're taking a little different approach because it's actually the first ever what, Matt?
The first ever referee.
Did you not know the answer to that, bro? We've never had a referee on our show, so another first year in White ended, which is going to be cool because it's going to be a different perspective.
Well, I'm sure some of the wrestlers we've had before have been special guest referees, but...
Well, that doesn't count.
Hey, Robbie, you ever been a special guest referee before?
Maybe a special enforcer, perhaps? No, I had to have been at some point. I can't remember. I get hit in the head a lot.
I bet you wear that really tight... referee shirt the way Vince
where my
does.
Belly button sticks out. And I mean, you also definitely know I call it right down the middle.
Down the middle, 100%. And last week we had, not only did we meet last week, but we also had Shannon Moore. What did you think about that Shannon Moore interview? What's the feedback you've gotten?
It was a great interview. And I mean, it was just cool. Again, I know we said it last week, but it was just so cool to hear how everyone, so many stars came out of that little Omega that they had. And, you know, it was really just all started as kids kind of just playing.
Yeah, I call it a talent hub, you know, and I think I said it to him where these little specks on the map where so many people of some industry came from. And, you know, people like to talk about Texas State University, West Texas State University, or Robbinsdale, Minnesota as being two hubs. But that Omega area, that North Carolina area is really where so many wrestlers came from. You could start naming them now and not be done for a while.
I mean, well, think about it. Definitely a lot of guys I was fans of when I was, you know, a kid in middle school. And I mean, Matt Hardy, Jeff Hardy, Shane Helms, Shannon Moore, Joey Abs from the Mean Street Posse. I mean, whatever. The list goes on and on. Christian York, Joey Matthews. But it is. I mean, think of what all those guys did.
And Trevor Lee is a second generation guy from that same area.
Yeah, Trevor Lee is one of the, I can't believe I'm actually saying this because we have a war on text message regularly, but he's actually one of the most talented dudes out there right now. So yeah, he's from there also.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talked a little bit about who our guest is today, and I, you know, have a lot of questions about what a referee does. I know you probably know, and you and Jimmy might feel it's something that is boring to people, but I want to know about how things get timed out or what certain things mean. I think our fans want to hear that kind of stuff. The referee's job isn't easy, is it?
Oh, no. And I mean, he's got a lot of stories to tell. He was with WWF, WWE. I mean, I'm just going to take a guess and say give or take 20 years, maybe more, maybe less, but around then. So he's got to have so many stories. He's a real great guy, super nice. And I actually read his book, and I know he's got a lot of good stories. So I'm hoping that he shares some with you guys today. And I'm looking forward to this interview.
And you guys heard something really awesome just now. Robbie read a book, and the person whose book he read is Jimmy Corderas. Coming up now.
There was a lot of pictures.
Yeah, there had to be. On Why It?
Do I say ended? Ended.
I have a college degree.
StopUsingYourHand.com.
Now, of course, you know by now about our great sponsor, Pleasure Products USA. They are a huge supporter of Why It Ended and also your online destination for innovative quality and affordable items geared towards men's sexual pleasure. As you know, or you probably should know, their signature product is the 3B Starlet Stroker. That's right, the 3B Starlet Stroker. It has an amazing, realistic internal texture, multiple vibration settings, and for the finishing maneuver, an actual voice of an adult film star is recorded to the device to make more than the crowd pop. Now, if you're not sure about this, and this is all new to you, check this out. you can try a free, that's right, a free stroker. All you have to do is just pay the shipping and handling of $6.95. For just $6.95 shipping and handling, you can get a free stroker. All you got to do is go to pleasureproductsusa.com/promo. That's slash promo. And enter the coupon code FISTBUMP. So whether you're going to get the 3D Scarlet Stroker, or you just want to dip your toe in the water, so to speak, with this free stroker for only $6.95 shipping and handling, make sure to check out our good friends at StopUsingYourHand.com. Now remember, to get that free stroker, go to PleasureProductsUSA.com/promo, and the coupon code is FISTBUMP. That's pretty funny. But you know what's not funny? PleasureProductsUSA, StopUsingYourHand.com. Today. All right, guys. Now, joining us this week, we have one of the most well-known referees, I'd say, in WWE history. We have Jim. Of course, they call him Jimmy Corderas. Mr. Corderas, how are you doing today?
I'm great. And please, just call me Jimmy or Jim. That works just fine. But I don't know about the famous. Timmy White was actually... Well, and you got Earl Hebner, who apparently screwed Brett many years ago. But anyway.
Well, you're definitely up there with him, man. And hey, you're definitely the most famous ref that's ever been on Wide Ended, because I was going to break the news to you that you're actually our first referee that we ever had on here. So I think our fans are going to be excited to hear a story about a career of someone that wasn't a wrestler, but yet a referee. So this is going to be cool.
Oh, that's cool for me, too. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. So how did you, like, why wrestling? Was it something that you fell in love with when you were a little kid, later on in life? How did you first start to realize that this is something that you loved and wanted to do?
Yeah, it's to make a very long story short, you know, growing up here in Canada, obviously hockey is king. And, you know, as a kid growing up a Maple Leafs fan, my older brother, who's 9 years older, when he was in high school, him and his buddies would go down to the Maple Leaf Gardens and they take in the old Maple Leaf wrestling at the time. And one time he decided to bring me along because he was pretty much babysitting me that day, and he reluctantly brought me along. And I used to watch it on television and I liked it, but when I saw it live, it was like something triggered inside me. And it was like, this is the coolest thing. And then for years watching it on television and bugging the crap out of him to keep taking me, of course he wouldn't, but you know, so eventually I got old enough. When I turned, you know, 16 and I got my license, and I would drive down to Maple Leaf Gardens, and I was like a regular. I was there. At that time, they did shows every 3 weeks at Maple Leaf Gardens. And then on Mondays, they would do TV tapings in Brantford, Ontario.
And who were some of the wrestlers at the time that were there?
It was when I was really getting into it as a mid-teenager, like around 16, 17, that was most of the talent was booked through Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. So we were getting the Ric Flairs. We were getting the... Johnny Weavers, we were getting Paul Jones, we were getting Greg Valentine, Jimmy Snuka when he was there, Ray Stevens when he was there, Ricky Steamboat, Jay Youngblood was, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, my favorite tag team, and maybe to this day, still, of all time, my favorite tag team ever. It was mostly Mid-Atlantic talent. But the cool thing about Toronto was, the promoter at that time, Frank Tunney, not only got guys from Mid-Atlantic, he also got WWF guys, AWA guys, you know, and I was one of these guys who bought all the magazines too.
And those magazines were the kind of inroad to a lot of us to learn about wrestlers that didn't wrestle in our area.
Yeah. And of course they were a couple of months behind back in those days, but you know, all of a sudden you're getting guys like the Grappler coming up here, and I'm going, oh cool, this guy's from Tennessee. You know, I read it in the magazine, and it just, like I said, I fell in love with it.
That's cool to hear, because for me, I always think of, you know, the Maple Leaf Gardens and that area as a WWF territory. And as far as you growing up watching Mid-Atlantic there, that's news to me. That's awesome. And what led to you starting to get involved? Did you want to be a wrestler?
Everybody, I think, that loves this industry kind of has that in the back of their mind. I didn't know that I was able to do it. You know, I was somewhat athletic in school. I mean, like I played football and volleyball and soccer and stuff like that. but this was that's a completely different world, as Robbie could tell you. But it was weird. I wanted to get involved in the business somehow. I didn't know how to. So what I did was, it's kind of weird. I used to go to the Maple Leaf Gardens every 3 weeks. Like I said, I had the same seats every week, which was second row ringside. Right beside, they had this elevated ramp that was level with the ring that would go from the locker room to the ring. And I would take pictures of the boys when they'd come out, you know, because they'd always stop there and they'd pose and they'd do their stuff, you know, and I'd take pictures and I'd come back the next show and sell them. So basically what I was doing was I was fueling my wrestling habit by selling these pictures. They were paying for the tickets, the parking, you know, and making a few bucks on the side.
Who were you? What were you selling the pictures to, like, fans?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So you were a hustler back then.
Yeah, man. I was out the back on Wood Street and behind Maple Leaf Gardens, and I'm like selling my pictures. And then one day, guy that worked for Jack Tunney, his name was Elio Zarlanga. He also was his photographer and did the program for Jack Tunney at Maple Leaf Gardens. And he comes up, he goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm selling pictures. You want to buy one? I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
You know? No, you can't do that. That's not legal. So what are you talking about? He says, no, it's copyright. And he's going through all this. So I'm playing dumb and I'm going, I'm in deep doo-doo here. So I'm just play dumb. See what happens. And, you know, I kind of baby-faced him a little bit. Even back then, I didn't know what I was doing, but I baby-faced him. And he says, tell you what. He says, you don't seem like a bad guy. Just don't do it out here. Go down like the block of them. Maybe a block away where you're not in front of the building or behind the building where anybody can see you. And, you know, just do it there. Just don't do it in plain sight. And I said, okay, cool. Thanks. I appreciate it. And week after week, we became friendly and we ran into each other at an indie show. And he said, hey, you know what? I'm going to introduce you to Jack and see if maybe you can take pictures with me and stuff like that. And he introduced me to Jack. And Jack said, well, we don't need another photographer, but we'll find something for the kid to do. And it started there by driving the boys and setting up the ring and doing all that stuff.
And were you alone at like did your friends from high school and stuff, were they wrestling fans too? Or are you kind of like the only one?
No, I was kind of pretty much the only one. The other guys were not, they watched occasionally, but they weren't diehard fans. I was a diehard fan. I was like, you know, every Saturdays don't bother me because, like I said, here in Toronto, we got Maple Leaf Wrestling. We got Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. We had international wrestling from Montreal. We even got on one of the Barrie stations over here. We would get Stampede Wrestling from Calgary. One of the other networks carried AWA out of Winnipeg. I mean, it was a wrestling smorgasbord here in Toronto. It was amazing.
And then from there, how did you get connected to eventually start with WWF? How does that happen?
Well, at the time when I got introduced to Jack, WWF had just purchased the territory from him. So it was like WWF really from the get-go. And after about a year and a half of doing all the cool stuff, like setting up the ring and stuff like that, Pat Patterson, who is basically the lead agent at the time, he just said to Jack, he said, look, we got the kid here. He sets up the ring. He waits around all through the show and to tear down and head to the next town. He says, why don't we use him during the show? We'll make him a referee. And Jack said to Pat, well, we don't want to smarten the kid up. And Pat's, I can't do a Pat Patterson voice, but it's good, you know, that accent. And he says, hey, what do you mean smarten the kid up? He's in the locker room with the boys. He's been here over a year. Like, you know, let's utilize him, you know? So Pat came up to me and told me, he says, get a blue shirt, a bow tie, black pants, and black running shoes and carry it with you.
Exclusive to that area, when did you start going on the road with them and doing shows all over and becoming a full-time employee?
Yeah, it's a long, weird story, but basically I started refereeing in 1987. I'm carbon dating myself here. I want to say February or early March. It was like a month before WrestleMania 3. I started refereeing up here in Ontario and Canada and like a little bit of upstate New York because, you know, Buffalo area and that kind of stuff because it's close and even into kind of Michigan and Detroit. But then at the time, after about, I want to say mid-87, like around June-ish, they were doing TV in Glens Falls, New York. And Jack Tunney at the time needed someone to drive him there because he had surgery done on his eye and he couldn't fly and he had to drive and he couldn't see to drive. So he asked me if I would take him to, and I said, sure. And I even knew back then, bring your stuff with you. And I got to work my first TV back then. And then they just said, you know what, bring him to the TVs from there on end. And for a while there, I was doing TVs every week and until, there was a little break there where I wasn't doing it for a while because they realized that, oh, wait, what, to make a long story short, they needed Canadian content for their television to air up here. So I was technically Canadian content. Yeah, because I'm Canadian, I'm from here. And then the issue was getting proper work papers, and that took a long time.
So what was the first, like, really big match that you refereed for WWF with huge superstars?
Well, it was during those tapings. Back then, they'd do every 3 weeks, they would do superstars and challenge and tape 3 weeks worth of television, but they'd always have that big dark match. And then 1 week, I don't remember that. I wish I could remember the town, but okay, you're doing the dark match with Hulk Hogan and Killer Khan. And I went, wow. What? And I said, yeah. And I said, oh my God, that is so cool. He says, and by the way, you're getting the green mist. And I went, what? So, what do you want me to do? When you get sprayed, just act like it's burning your eyes and all that. Okay, I'll do my best. Thank you. But it turned out okay, I guess. But the hard part was getting that green stuff off. It just wouldn't come off.
We have heard that before, I think, from Glacier, right, Robbie?
Well, yeah, for me too. Muda, Tajiri, I've had it, and I think Muda's mist was on me for like 3 days, man.
Oh my God, I think it's a rib. I mean, I'm sure there's something they could use that won't stain you for life, but I think they have fun with it.
I think it sounds like fun. Hey, so one thing that people ask about and people know about you is at WrestleMania 4, mm-hmm. which of course is known as, you know, the WrestleMania that had the tournament. You were knocked unconscious after Jimmy Hart hit you with the megaphone. Was that the first time you were seriously injured or injured in the ring?
Yeah, pretty much. I have to dispel the urban myth. It wasn't Jimmy who actually did it. I did it to myself.
How so?
Well, the deal, he popped up on the apron and I'm trying to chase him off. And as I turn my back, he swings the megaphone and I get, quote unquote, knocked out, but I face planted down. It was WrestleMania. I wanted it to look good. And I guess when my chin hit the canvas, it hit that right spot where I just went out. I just blanked out. So it wasn't the actual megaphone that knocked me out. It was me doing it to myself. And the only thing I remember is Joey saying, you know, call for the bell, call for the bell. But I was like in La La Land and then next thing you know, they're dragging me out of there. Like sheep dragging me. The fun part was I get to the back and it's like, you know, like the cobwebs start clearing. Wow, I wish those guys would stop with the blower up there. So the cobwebs start clearing and everybody's like, are you okay? And now I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Why? Oh, you don't remember? No. Oh, okay.
And to take people a little bit behind the scenes, Jimmy's having some roofing work done right now, but that's what the noise you hear. It's not that bad, but just let people know. But also let people know behind the scenes. Robbie's a wrestler. He knows. You're, of course, a referee. You know. I'm a fan. I've been watching a long time. I'm as knowledgeable, I guess, as a fan can be. But maybe you can clue people in to what the referee's actual job is in a wrestling match and maybe how it's evolved over the years.
Yeah, it's amazing because it has evolved over the years because depending on certain matches, like it depends on the story that the talent wants to tell. It's their story, and basically, what the referee is the supporting cast player to help them tell their story. So it's kind of like you're the guy in the background, kind of invisible until you need to be visible. But basically, what you're doing is you're helping them tell the story that they want to tell. Over the years, you know, it's been different, like depending on the match and who's in there and the story you want to tell. It could be, you know, a hard fought, brutal battle. It could be a little more comedic at times and stuff like that. But I know the role has changed for referees over the year in the WWE because they want, at least they claim they want them to be more taken more seriously. But there are times where, you know, depending, a little ha-ha goes on every once in a while.
And it's true now. Most referees don't even have names currently, right? At least a few of them, they don't even go by names. They're just kind of a person that's in the ring.
Yeah, they kind of they occasionally mention. They throw it out there every once in a while, but for the most part, they don't. Because I think in their mind, they're thinking they're not the attraction, they're not the focal point. The talent are the ones who draw attention to the, you know, to the television or to whatever medium you're watching on.
As a referee, though, I've noticed over the years that it seems that referees have more and more responsibility as far as time cues, especially for live TV and stuff like that. Has it always been that right way, or has the referee's role become more important with the advent of more live television?
It has evolved over the time from when I was doing it, because when we first started wearing the IFBs, basically we were told, we're giving you these just so we can communicate times with you. It's a lot easier than trying to eyeball the timekeeper at ringside with a pencil in his mouth to get the cue to go home, you know? So it's a lot easier. You can count them down. You can keep the guys informed where they're at in the match. And instead of looking for hand signals, like, you know, six to go, five to go, whatever the case may be. But then it started getting into, all right, tell the guys to do this. And you're like, okay. You know, like, oh, but you know, it started evolving into, now they're calling spots from the back. Like the producers or the agents would call a spot from the back. And I'm thinking, it's hard enough to communicate with the talent as it is without looking like you're actually passing on time cues or whatever. Now you're actually telling me to give them like a 15-second spot. How do I do this? You know, it started getting a little crazy at one time. But the worst part was, it depended. If it was like a quote-unquote younger talent who are still in the evolving stages, it's different. But you got guys in there like Booker T and stuff like that, and they're saying, tell Booker, and I'm like, no. And they're like, well, tell Taker this. Taker? No. You know what I mean? And you know, quick story, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I remember one time Mickey Henson came up to me, and he says, I noticed that they tell you, you know, tell Taker to do this and tell Taker to do that. And you lean in and you talk to him, and he says, what do you say to him? I said, well, they tell me, hey, tell Taker this. And I lean in and I go, 6 minutes. That's all you're getting from me.
Yeah.
Was
there times where you had Vince in your headset while you're in the ring?
No, that's the funny thing. People always ask that because I keep hearing he's constantly in the ear of the announcers, but never the referees. And I think part of the reason why is, you know, if you know Vince McMahon, he's somewhat intimidating. It doesn't mean to be, but, you know, and if you hear that voice in the middle of the match, he doesn't want to throw the guys off. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, what does Vince want? Uh-oh. Now you got the deer in the headlights look, and people are like, what the hell is he doing? So it's usually the producer of the match or whoever's timing the show that talks to the referees.
So you would have just the agent for the match in your headset, or maybe, you know, someone who was not Vince who had responsibility in your ear?
Yeah, exactly. But Vince would pass messages through them if he wanted to tell the referee something.
Well, we're definitely going to get to that. And, you know, we've talked about, or people may know, I know I knew, and some people do not know, that you were the referee, of course, who was in the ring at Over the Edge when the tragedy with Owen Hart occurred. And you've talked about it a little bit, and the fact that he was yelling to you when he came down. And people say, and you've heard, that he was yelling at you to get out of the way. Let me ask you this, is something so terribly tragic that happened. How often do you think of that day and that moment with Owen Hart? It has to be something that still rings in your memory quite often.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't want to say that I think about it every day, but it pops into my mind a lot. It's for me, one of the worst days ever, you know, for me personally, professionally, however you want to categorize it. And yeah, I mean, you know, I heard yelling, and I heard people saying that it was him yelling, and I can't confirm that, but I would not doubt it, knowing the kind of guy he is, that he was coming down and probably saw it. Because what a lot of people don't realize is that right before that incident happened, there was a hardcore match in the ring, and there's a lot of debris scattered around, and we were clearing out stuff from the ring, and as we were clearing out stuff, I was actually moving towards that corner that he fell in. And I didn't find out till the next day from Jerry Lawler, who said he saw about the last 15, 20 feet of Owen's fall. And he said right away, I thought, oh my goodness, he's going to fall on Jimmy. And I was apparently that close to it.
Is it true that he brushed against you or touched you as he fell down?
Yeah, I don't know if it was his hand or his foot, but like I was holding the top rope as I was kicking debris out of the ring and moving towards that corner. And almost instantaneously, I felt something brush against my head and the top rope snapped out of my hand and snapped back. And jammed my fingers. And I thought the rope broke. Like that, because they use actual rope in the WWE, it's not cable. So I thought, oh my goodness, the rope broke, and I'm looking and the rope's intact. And I'm like, what the hell? Somebody throw something? And as I turned around, you know, there he was. And I was like, okay, you know what I mean? It's like, you're trying to put two and two together and you can't.
Yeah. It all happened so quick. And I'm sure the first thing that your first thought wasn't even, it was as bad as it was probably.
And,
right?
And it makes no sense when you're trying to figure it. There's Owen, there's somebody in the ring who wasn't in the ring, and your brain can't put it together as quickly as it happened.
Right. And there was a loud bang too, at the same time. Like I said, a fraction of a second, all this happened. And, you know, I turned around and I walked to him and I called out a couple of times and there was no response. And then I just freaked out and started calling for help.
Wow.
And, wow. That is, and you're not in the business of I've followed you on Twitter and I know you're not in the business of being super critical for the sake of being critical of the WWF, but with the benefit of hindsight, do you think it was the right decision to go on with that pay-per-view? I don't think they would do it again, but at the time, did that seem like the right decision?
To be honest with you, I don't know, because in today's environment, I would say they wouldn't do it. Back then, it was. I don't want to sound callous about this either, but it's weird. It's almost like it's a precedent that's never been set before. I don't recall it ever happening where a talent had passed away during an event. I'm sure it's happened somewhere in the world, but I don't recall it, and I don't know that there was ever a precedent for it. I mean, Vince gave everybody the option. You know? He went apparently to the talent locker room. Do we keep going or do we stop? And you know, it was their vote.
And the talent decided to go on with the show.
Yeah, they were. If they didn't want to go on, I mean, like you weren't going to force them, because if you think of the talent that went on afterwards, like Stone Cold and The Undertaker. You know, they had the stroke to say no if they wanted to.
And it was probably along the lines of Owen would have wanted the show to go on. Maybe they were thinking.
Exactly. That's exactly what they were thinking.
And it was probably apparent. You were right there. Probably apparent to you right away that this was serious, like right away.
Oh, yeah. That's like I said, I kind of freaked out, started calling Mark Ayton, who is the timekeeper, started saying, talk to the back. We need help out here. I don't know what's happening. And again, in hindsight, afterwards, I didn't realize it at the time, but thinking back to it, I remember looking at seeing Owen's forearm on the inside of his forearm. There looked like a chunk of flesh had been scooped out, like with an ice cream scooper. Just a missing piece of flesh there, but there was it wasn't bleeding. It wasn't like, you know, it was weird. And you know, this is all stuff you process like 2 days later that pop into your head and go, you know what I mean?
What did that hit the post, his forearm?
a post, maybe the rope.
Yeah. At that speed, it could have been anything. It just.
Yeah. And yeah, see, and it's stuff that hits you like I didn't realize I'm looking at it that day, but you know, like a day or two later, it's like I tell people, they had me go to the hospital as a precaution, just to make sure I was okay, because I was an emotional wreck too, as well. And I tell people the next day we were in St. Louis, and I don't for the life of me remember going from Kansas City to St. Louis to this day. I don't know how I got there. Don't remember if we took a car. I don't remember if we flew. Don't remember if we took a bus, a crew bus or something. I just don't remember going from Kansas City to St. Louis.
You were shut down. The shock of it was just so much that, you know, just you were, yeah. You definitely were in shock for sure.
Yeah, I would say.
Absolutely. And I think that's fair to say that they had never crossed that bridge before. You'd never had a talent have that kind of accident before, and you almost had to go through it to know not to do it, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that's fair. And I don't know how we transition out of this subject into another one, but I'm going to go ahead and try. In 1999, it was the first time it was really the first time I ever heard the name Jim Corderis. And you were the only one who did not join the strike. You were the scab, and you were like, I remember, I think you were beat yeah. down, you know, you were beat down by the other referees at some point. How did that come about? Why were you the one out? And how did you enjoy being, you know, part of an angle for the first time?
It was cool to get my 15 minutes of fame without having to turn heel, because, you know, historically referees who turn heel, how do you go back? You know what I mean? It's like your longevity is shot, but it started as pretty much a joke. I had gotten married a few weeks earlier. And I went on my honeymoon. They were nice enough to give me 2 weeks. So my wife and I went, my new bride, we went on a 2 week honeymoon. And when I came back, obviously they were setting up that angle for the referees to go on a strike. But for 2 weeks, I hadn't been watching because, come on, it's your honeymoon. So you don't want to start off the marriage that way by watching wrestling every week. So when I come back there, everybody's explaining the angle to me. Oh, we're on strike. We're doing this. We're doing that. I said, oh, cool. So I run into Hunter in the hallway, and he used to call me Corduroy. He said, hey, Corduroy, welcome back. How was the honeymoon? I said, it was great, man. It was great. He says, too bad you guys are out of a job. Ha, 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 ha. So I just turned to him and I said, well, I can't go on strike because I just got married. I need the money. I said, maybe we could show me showing up with my bags and you know, trying to walk through the picket line, going to the guys, hey, guys, what's up? I've been away. You know, we're on strike. Well, I can't do it. And the guys all waffle me with their signs. And the next shot, you see me all beat up, but still walking around striking with the rest of the referees. And he went, ha ha, that's pretty funny. Hey, JR, come here. Then next thing you know, I'm a scab referee. So it started kind of like it's a joke that ended up being an angle on TV.
Nice. Well, it definitely got you the 15 minutes of fame, so it's well worth it, right?
Oh, sure. Why not? Everybody's entitled to at least 15 minutes.
Hey, so guys, remember the days when you were always ready to go? Well, now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in the bedroom. Listen up.
BlueChew.com, and it's blue just like the color blue. Now, BlueChew.com brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work.
And you can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises.
Blue Chew is prescribed online and it ships straight to your door in a discreet package. Now, I know people who've gotten this package, and I'm telling you, that's the truth. So no in-person doctor's visit, no waiting in the pharmacy, and the best of all, no more awkwardness.
And they're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a normal pharmacy.
And right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free. You can get it for free. What do you have to lose when you use our special promo code, Robbie? All you have to do is just pay the $5 shipping.
And again, guys, that's BlueChew.com and promo code Robbie. Not Robbie E, Robbie. Try it free today.
And it's Blue Chew, B-L-U-E, chew.com. And it is the better, cheaper, faster choice. And thanks for sponsoring the podcast. Now, I'm not lying. I know some guys who have gotten Blue Chew, and they swear by it. So give it a chance today, bluechew.com/Robbie.
Well, you were years later, you were in the ring when the Kurt Angle, Daniel Pewter thing went down. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's weird how that went about, because all day long they had the Tough Enough guys doing all these like wind sprints and trying to blow them up all day long and eat like massive amount of pasta in between and just like, you know, trying to get them to throw up and stuff like that. And then they had them do, I guess they were called squat thrusts.
Yeah.
Or we used to call them burpees or something like that back in the day. But so they had them just go until they dropped, until there was one left. So as we're watching, Charles Robinson and I are the officials in the ring. And the last guy left was not Daniel Pewter, even though he was the guy who didn't drop. For some reason, they said, hey, the blonde guy's not doing it right. Eliminate him. So we picked the wrong blonde guy.
Oh, really? So he was supposed to be eliminated.
So Pewter wasn't supposed to be eliminated, but ended up getting eliminated. So Kurt had that impromptu amateur wrestling match with the other kid, and I can't remember his name, darn, but just ate him alive. And this was Kurt at maybe 70%, if that.
Chris Nowrocki was his name?
I don't remember which one of the blonde guys. But yeah, so he just ate him up for a few minutes. And like I said, Kurt was not 100%. He was still hurting. His neck was giving him problems. He was, you can see it bothering his, like down his arms and stuff. So, you know, he went to the rest of the cast and says, hey, anybody else want to challenge me? And of course, Pewter put his hand up, and what are you going to do now? So Pewter gets in the ring and they start rolling around, and I'm looking at Al Snow, and Al's giving me the, I don't know, what are we doing here?
And then this is live on SmackDown?
Yeah, this is on SmackDown, and this is what we weren't expecting. We weren't expecting this from Kurt at all, to call somebody out, you know? And so I'm looking at Al, he's looking at us, he's going, I don't know. So they back up into a corner, and I could see, I'm not well-versed in MMA, but I know enough to know what a key lock is. And I see Daniel Pewter apply a key lock, and I'm thinking, oh, this is not going to be good, because knowing Kurt, he'd rather lose his arm than give up to this kid. And it's funny because, like I said, I'm not well-versed in MMA. I'm I guess what you would call a casual MMA fan. And back then, even more casual. But I did recognize the Kimura only because, speaking with guys like Taz, and stuff like that. So, I thought, yeah, Kurt's not going to tap. There's no way. He'd rather lose his arm, have it ripped out of its socket before he gave up to this kid. And again, I'm in my mind, I'm just thinking, what do we do? You know, how do we get out of this? This is not good.
So you knew it almost immediately.
Once he got his arm locked behind him, I said, oh my goodness, this is not going to end well. And by chance, it wasn't like I said, okay, as soon as they land on the ground, I'm going to do this. It just, they went to the ground, Kurt fell on top. And just for some reason, my brain told me count. So I counted three, even though technically one of his shoulders was up after maybe one or two. But, my thought process was, got to end this, get the hell out of there, because somebody's going to get really hurt.
And you saved the day, though. You got him out of it.
Again, one of those things in hindsight, I went like, phew. Then, Kurt was none too happy afterwards. And you're thinking back and I go, well, they were doing an amateur style wrestling thing. A, the hold shouldn't have been allowed. And B, it's amateur. I could have only counted one and got out of it that way.
what was Kurt unhappy at you for counting the three, or at the whole situation that happened?
No, he was cussing. He was cussing Pewter out and basically calling him out because it wasn't a wrestling you know, in amateur wrestling, you can't put holds on like Kimuras and stuff like that. And that's what he was basically cussing him out for.
Got it. And did he, how was that atmosphere in the back? Was Peter apologetic or like, what was the,
I kind of stayed away from that situation. Yeah. I got to the back and, first person I saw was Gerald Briscoe, who just nodded as I walked by, didn't say anything. And then I ran into Fit Finley in the back and Fit said, did they tell you to count? I said, no, I just did it. He said, well, good for you then. And that was it. You know, and then I just thought best to keep away from, there's certain things you wish you were there for. I didn't want to be anywhere near this one.
It's crazy looking back like that and thinking that something actually went out there, like, you know, some of it unscripted like that, where on the fly, someone could just say, I'm going to wrestle you. And it happened on live TV, because that would never happen now in 2018, you know?
No, nothing like that will happen. And I know sometimes they try to, again, let's put it this way, kayfabe the boys by not telling them what's going to happen in the ring, but those that are participating in the ring do know.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the boys in the back, like, okay, we're going to keep this under wraps and we're going to try and get everybody. And doesn't always happen, but sometimes they try to do it.
Hey, Matt, do you know any MMA holds?
No, I don't know anything. I don't know.
Do you have an amateur background in wrestling or no?
I have very limited athletic experience. I walk to my car.
Did you play Little League Baseball?
I did, actually. I did play sports when I was
young. Well, there you go. That's something.
That's not too bad. It's not too bad. Hey, so in your time in WWF, WWE, who were your friends? Who did you hang out with? Who did you ride with?
It was pretty much the riding crew was for the longest time. The best way I could describe it, Tony Chimmel to me was what Al Snow was to Mick Foley. He used to joke about being irreplaceable with the company, and I'd tell him that my back was killing me from carrying him for 20 years. And we were just, you need that guy to balance things out, because it is stressful on the road. You're away from your family. And I know it sounds very cliche, but the guys that you ride with are your road family. And for me, it was guys like Chimmel, Charles Robinson was in the group, Larry Heck, who is the athletic trainer. It was funny because that the three of us were like pretty much almost a constant. But, you know, we had other riding partners. When I first started, it was a little bit different because you kind of like bounced around. And I had the ring truck back then. Back then we drove the ring truck. And then eventually it evolved into where, you know, they'd do the house shows / live events, and they'd use an 18-wheeler, which we couldn't drive. So we drove cars, which was cool, which we preferred. But Chimmel and Larry and Hornswoggle was in there for a little while, and Kyoto. Oh, yeah, when you can get him off his damn phone. Kyoto would be fun for the first 5 minutes until he fell asleep, and then Chimmel and I would have conversations, just look back and go, what do you think about that, Kyoto? And of course we get the snoring. But
it seems to me the time, you know, from what I hear from you and wrestlers and writers, it seems very segregated in the back, almost like wrestlers hang with wrestlers, writers hang with writers, referees hang with referees. Is that pretty much the way it was?
Not by design. I think it just the way things worked out. I mean, like, you know, with the referees, especially doing double duty because refereeing and also setting up the ring, these are the guys you hang with, and you have to stay later than pretty much everybody else. So the boys want to leave. They're not going to wait around, and you don't want them to wait around. So, you know, the referees will hang together with Chimmel, who also did the ring crew as well. So we kind of hung around like that. And if anything, Larry, who is a trainer who didn't have to hang around, would hang around because, you know, we were buddies, you know?
So the refs stuck around the show and actually, like, you're reffing a big event and you still have to stay afterwards and break the ring down.
Yeah. I didn't mind. It was double dipping. Basically you're getting two paychecks. You're getting one to referee, to do ring crew. And here's the other thing too, that the little perk when you're doing ring crew, the travel as far as car and hotel is paid for.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, and when you're just a referee, you are basically like the boys. You travel like the boys. You pay for your own hotel and all that stuff.
Are you, as a referee, are you an independent contractor or are you an employee of WWE?
Independent contractor. It's the same structure as the talent.
So you still have to find your own health insurance and paid travel and all that, like you were saying.
Yes, exactly. But if you're doing the ring crew, then you don't have to pay for the travel. As far as the health insurance goes, you need the health insurance for outside of work, because if you are injured while on the job at WWE, like if you get injured in the ring or doing your job, your medical expenses will be taken care of.
Got it. So, Jimmy, over the years, have there ever been any wrestlers that, like, you tried to stay away from that you just didn't want to work with? They gave you a problem a lot or didn't like the way you reffed, or did you ever do something wrong in a match or something?
Not that really that I wanted to stay away from it. Not from that standpoint, like not from this guy scares the crap out of me or whatever. I did have one little incident with Lex Luger a while back, and it was a match. I was supposed to take a bump in the match, and I had a brain fart, and it was just basically one of those ones where he has Crush in a headlock, and Crush shoots him off, and he runs into me, and I take a bump. But for some reason, I had a brain fart and kind of matadored him. It stepped out of the way, and Lex stopped and looked at me. He goes, "What are you doing?" And I looked at him and said, "I don't know." And Crush was laughing. Brian was laughing his ass off. So then we just did, the double do-si-do squisher in the corner thing. And we get to the back, and he's cussing a strip off me. And I'm like, I'm taking it. Like, that's what you do, right? You just sit there and take it. And then the one line he said was, you effed up the whole match. And Brian, on cue, just piped up. He said, "Nah, Lex, you did that long before he missed the bump." And he was like, "Thank you, sir. Thank you. I appreciate it."
Now, these days, and I'm going to speak firsthand because it's StarCast, my son and I got to accompany and hang out with Lex Luger pretty much an entire day as we were with him during signings and stuff. And I can testify to the fact that he's probably the nicest, coolest human being I've ever met in the entire world. So he's turned over a new leaf and he's really doing great now. But at the time, mm-hmm. He had a reputation for being really hard to work with.
Yeah, he just seemed grumpy all the time. You know what I mean? See, I consider myself one of these glass half full guys. I try my best to be, even in like on bad days, because everybody has them. I mean, like, not every day is biscuits and gravy. You know what I mean? You're going to have bad days, but I try to make the best of it anyways. And I was always one of these guys who was harder on myself whenever I screwed up. Like, it's just the way it is. And sometimes you're going to mess up. Nobody's perfect.
Any memorable interactions with Vince McMahon over the years?
Oh my goodness.
Where do you begin? Right.
Yeah, I know. Vince is both cool and scary at the same time. I always had a blast working for him. I remember like when I first started, refereeing on TV, there was an incident where I screwed up really bad in an 8-man tag match. And he was really upset and just, giving me the business backstage and telling me how now that match can't be shown on TV. It was so bad and all this stuff. And I felt like I'm ready to cry here after he walked away. And Jack Lanza came over and says, "Don't worry about it. Give it a few minutes. He'll calm down." And then like on cue, 15 minutes later, he came up to me. "I didn't mean to tear a strip off you, but I just blah, blah, blah." And he's going on and he's giving me the pep talk. Whereas 15 minutes ago, I felt like he was tearing a hide off me. So he went from disciplining dad to encouraging dad in like 15 minutes. And I thought, well, this is kind of cool. And then there's other times where Vince loves to rib. And I remember one time, just one of the things I helped out with. I was hanging some signs up in the backstage area, just, you know, and I was standing on a road case, and as I was reaching up on the road case to put up this sign, somebody shoves me from behind, and kind of like I stumble a little bit, and I hear the laugh, and it's Vince. And I was ready to turn around and say, "You, oh, hey, boss." And, you know, you get the Vince laugh. And
there's a famous story about him at a bar, I think it was in Texas, taking the finishers of wrestlers, like taking the Doomsday Device and taking the Bulldog's Power Slam. Were you there? Did you hear of that occurrence? Or
I heard about it. Honestly, I wish I was there to see it, but everybody was talking about it like the next week. It was like, did you, Vince took everybody's finish in the bar? And I said, wow, see, that's what happens when you have to stick around to do the ring. You miss all the good stuff.
You were there so long. Did you find that he changed from when you started to when you exited?
I think he mellowed out a little bit over that time. He was still very hands-on. I mean, the guy never sleeps. Let's put it that way. I don't know when he sleeps. But, you know, he wasn't. To give you an example, I told you that story about him cussing me out after the match and then coming back 15 minutes later. You know, there would be probably about 15 years after that, you know, you'd come back to Gorilla, and instead of getting that, you'd get Vince with his glasses at the bottom of his nose, and he'd give you the finger like, come here, and he'd calmly ask you, why did you do this in the match? You know, and you'd say, you try to come up with an explanation. And if he liked it, okay then. If he didn't, well, this is not what we want. We want this and this and this. And remember next time to do it this way.
So something I wanted to talk to you about was the Royal Rumble with Cena and Batista both being eliminated at the same time. And, you know, as the story goes, Cena, you were outside the ring, and Cena and Batista... I believe Batista was supposed to win. Cena and Batista both fell out of the ring. The SmackDown referees raised one hand. The Raw referees raised the other hand. Vince comes out, tears both his quads. It seems almost a little suspicious to me that that's the finish, because you referees were so quick on the ball to not just raise Batista's hand. What was going on in the headsets? What was going on out there during that crazy finish?
Yeah, so basically, you're right. Batista was supposed to win. They were supposed to both go over the top, but Dave was supposed to hook the top rope, and John was going to hit the floor, and Batista wins the Rumble and goes on to WrestleMania. Didn't work out that way. They both went over, and from where I was, you could see them both go over at the same time, but I couldn't see them landing. Charles was actually closer than I was. But when they landed, Jack Doan, knowing that Dave was supposed to be the one to go over in the match, just instinctively went over and raised Dave's hand, saying he landed, John landed first. And then apparently they looked back at the replay and they said, holy crap, they pretty much landed at the same time. So we heard in our earpiece, like seconds later, one of the SmackDown refs go in there and raise John's hand, because John was a SmackDown guy and Dave was a Raw guy. So, you know, dive in the ring. We raised John Cena's hand, and we started, no. He landed. Batista landed first. John Cena's the winner. And then the Raw guys were going, no, Cena landed first. Batista's the winner. And they were saying, you guys argue back and forth. And then we could hear in our earpiece, they were calling the other referees that weren't in the match to go find the respective GMs, who were Eric Bischoff and Teddy Long. Yeah, so they were calling to go find those two guys. Apparently, they decided to duck out early. So next thing you know, we're going back and forth, and they're screaming, somebody find those guys, find the GMs, and find Bischoff and Teddy. And next thing you know, here comes Vince storming out. So he was hot, not because of what was happening with the finish, was because those guys couldn't be found. So he starts tearing into the ring. He dives under the bottom rope. He goes to stand up, and he doesn't make it to his feet.
He's so heated, he tears both his quads. Now, all this stuff you're talking about is being done right on the fly. You know, you're being told to raise the hands on the fly. Who's in the headset talking to you at that time? Do you remember who it was?
I want to say it was it Bruce? It may have been Bruce. Was because most of the time it was Briscoe, Harold, or Mr. B, as I call him.
Is it the person at Gorilla who's normally in the headset?
Yes. Yep. So anybody else? I mean, I believe that the truck could talk to us too, but they prefer not to. So we're getting the messages from Briscoe, and then all of a sudden Vince goes down, and we're all thinking like, okay, this isn't right.
Right.
And he's not even trying to get back up. He's not even trying to stand up. And we hear, come here, damn it. No. Okay. So he went on and he told us to spiel. Here's what we're going to do. Continue the match and then just go to what the finish was supposed to be in the first place, the Dave going over. So he rolls out of the ring and somehow walked back.
He's crazy.
He's nuts.
He's the only guy in the world who could no sell two quad tears. Like, he did sell it all. He sat in the ring and yelled at people. And it's really amazing.
He helped himself along the barricade, along, you know, the back. And, you know, we're thinking, wow, I don't know, something's wrong. We didn't know at the time it was two torn quads, but we knew, you know, obviously, if he's not standing up, something's wrong with Vince.
And at the time when Vince comes down storming down the entryway, doing the most exaggerated Vince strut of all time, there had to be a point of view that was just like, oh shit, what's about to happen?
Yeah, we were all like, okay, is this Mr. McMahon or is this Vince that's really hot?
you're hoping it's Mr. McMahon.
Yes, exactly.
So, Jimmy, 20 plus years with WWF, WWE, awesome career. What eventually led to your exit?
A couple of things. Well, I was starting to break down, believe it or not, because even to this day, my knees are not 100%. My right elbow suffers a little bit too, but that wasn't it. My father got sick. When I was home, I took him to the doctor and we got him checked out, and he got diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And with my sister living out of town, and I needed to be home to look after things. So I took some time away, which they were again gracious about. And as you know, Robbie, it's if your heart isn't in it, you can't do this business. And, you know, my dad ended up passing away, and I just didn't have that desire to be away from my family. And so, you know, I talked to John Laurinaitis. We had a nice conversation and just said, you know, right now it's not, you know, we mutually agreed that this wasn't the right time, which is why I didn't get the ever popular, we wish you well in your future endeavors. I almost feel like I should have got at least that. So just, you know, it was just one of those things, the door is always open whenever you want to come back and that kind of stuff. But it just, my heart wasn't there anymore. And if you can't commit 100% to this business, you can't do it.
So, what is Jimmy Corderas up to now? What are you doing with yourself? I know you do some radio.
We did do radio. That's long story short, the station that we had, myself and Arto O'Cal, who ended up being Kyle Edwards in WWE a little while ago, we used to do a little show called Right After Wrestling, which morphed into Aftermath, which was on Sirius XM here in Canada. But that station is no longer, it's defunct, so... we don't do that anymore, unfortunately. And Arda is now in the U.S. doing his thing, and I'm still up here in Canada. But we have a show up here in Canada called Aftermath. It's still on television. It's actually national broadcast television. The station, Rogers Sportsnet 360, which airs all the WWE television programming up here. We do a show called Aftermath. It's kind of like, the way I like to describe it, it's like a wrestling version of The Talking Dead, where... where myself, the artist formerly known as Santino Morella, Anthony Corelli, and an improv comic who has done several movies, Nug Nargang, we do a show, and it's hosted by a young lady named Caroline Schved. Yes, I'm pronouncing that correctly, for those who think I'm...
It's a cool
name. She's been on with us for less than a year, but she's fabulous, and we have a lot of fun. We talk about the show. We talk about Raw. What did we like? What we didn't like? And we don't go too inside baseball, but at the same time, we talk about the stuff, a little behind the scenes stuff, but we don't tear down that fourth wall too much.
And you also have a book, right?
Yeah, I wrote a book a few years ago called The Three Count, My Life in Stripes as a WWE Referee. There may be another one in the works. I'm kind of gathering some stuff together and maybe do a part two.
And what about, are you still taking bookings if someone wanted you to referee a match or for appearances or stuff like that?
Very limited. I mean, like there's a group out here that based out of Toronto called Smash Wrestling that, I like them. They're good people. Like I don't want to do too much because my knees are the drizzling, you know what, but because I'm an idiot, because when I started, it was like, no, you can't wear knee pads. That's not cool. You know, don't wear knee pads. No. And then like 15 years later, like, what an idiot. Why wasn't I wearing knee pads?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know what I'm talking about. It's just, but very limited every once in a while. I'll do some stuff with them. And they're on the Fight Network up here in Canada, which is kind of cool. So I do occasional referee spots, but very limited.
Cool. And then, I was going to say, and then what about Twitter, Instagram, stuff like that?
Yeah, on Instagram, it's Real Jimmy Corderas. On Twitter, people have this misconception about me on Twitter. I use it to amuse myself.
You're so mean. You're like the nicest guy in this interview, but on Twitter, you are the worst, man. You just like, you will not hesitate to let someone know how you feel and really shoot down a bunch of trolls and just, you know, really, really, you're kind of mean on Twitter. I got to say, you're the opposite of what I'm hearing right now.
Well, Twitter is both the best and worst thing that can happen to social media or anti-social media, because, you get some people on there that are really cool and you can have a nice, like, back and forth with them. Then other guys just come out of the blue and I'm not saying that I know everything about wrestling. I have my opinions, but at the same time, come on. Right, you know what I mean?
Right. At
least I do have a little bit of knowledge. I mean, like, people think, well, you were just a referee. No, I've actually sat there and listened to all these guys talk and teach and tried to learn. I tried to be more than just the guy who walks in there and counts three, you know?
Well, you're definitely a fun follow on Twitter at Jimmy Corderas, go ahead.
No, sorry to interrupt. No, it's just people get the misconception. I'm popping myself, if that makes
right.
sense, on Twitter. I use Twitter to amuse myself. And like I said, if somebody comes out and tries to act like a know-it-all smartass, I'm just going to, you know what? You're going to get know-it-all smartass back.
Well, I've definitely seen it for sure. And thank you so much for joining us, man. And you're a lot of fun. You've been an awesome guest, and we can't thank you enough for joining us today.
No, I thank you. I really appreciate it. I have fun. I love talking wrestling, man. It's what I do for a living now. So it's kind of cool. Before you couldn't get me to say anything. Now you can't get me to shut up.
Well, thank you, man. We appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Anytime.
So we heard a lot of interesting and maybe not even some happy stories on this episode of Why It Ended with Jim Corderas. For me, I think the Owen Hart story is the thing that will be remembered by most. What did you think about Jimmy Corderas' interview with us?
Yeah, I mean, that was... it's just thinking, I mean, I'm trying to find words to say what it possibly could have felt like to be standing still and feeling a body hit you. I just can't even, that whole scene kind of just makes me speechless a little bit. I don't even know how to, what to say about it.
And, you know, it's the Owen Hart death and the specifics of it have a lot of curiosity from the fans. And I know my curiosity was fulfilled and then some, and maybe some of those details don't need to be said, but I think what was heard was what people wanted to know. And of course, he was in the ring for many, many things. And just a stellar interview, another sleeper interview on why it ended. We're really doing some good. Hey, did you hear, by the way, Robbie, that we have changed another life? Did you know that?
Oh, no. Whose life? Yours?
So, right. Well, maybe a little bit. But right after our interview with a drunken Brutus the Barber Beefcake, where he talked about how much he wanted to reach out to Hulk Hogan and reconnect with Hulk Hogan, do you know what happened?
Enlighten me.
Hulk and him, I saw pictures of him and Hulk together, shaking hands, laughing. Hulk retweeted it, Beefcake retweeted it, Missy Beefcake retweeted it. So they're buddies again, and I'm going to go ahead and credit us.
Well, you know what? Why the hell not? We've done so much else in professional wrestling. I mean, you know, we're mending friendships now also.
Well, one thing we can't mend.
Did I use the word mending correctly?
Yeah, I think you did. I think I was scared when you started to use it, but then it turned out pretty good. And I was going to say a segue, and I had no segue. You interrupted me, thank God. But one thing that can't get interrupted is the Wyatt Ended train. And of course, if you want to check us out on Twitter, interact with us, say hi. At Why It Ended. And also check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/whyitended. A lot of you knew about this Jimmy Corderas interview before it came out, tweeted us about it, enjoyed it, and you're the first ones to know. So be the first on your block to hear an episode of Why It Ended.
Yeah, and then of course, Robbie E. Impact on Twitter, Real Robbie E. on Instagram, Pro Wrestling Tees. Get my shirts, get the Why It Ended shirts, and whereitended.com is their YouTube page. Let's not forget about. And then, of course, don't follow Matt Kuhn on anything.
And but make sure you follow the greatest wrestling podcast in the history of the world. Why It
Ended.